Ladies and gentlemen, start your stopwatches because you're listening to the Dispatches on the Clock, and that means we're going to spend the next 15 minutes or less talking about Dave Chappelle's recent appearance on Saturday Night Live and how, once again, he has used his comedic skills to challenge the dominant cultural narratives of the day. Now, before we go any further, just a couple of quick things. Number one is, if you hear building noises in the background, don't panic. That's real. There is some building work that is taking place quite close to my office today, and so you may well hear the sounds of drills and saws and hammers and stuff like that. Number two, I'm not sure if we are going to be able to stay within the 15-minute window today, because what I'm going to be doing is we're going to be listening to, and then I'm going to respond to, different segments from Dave Chappelle's recent appearance on Saturday Night Live, and so it may take a little longer than 15 minutes. Now, in true fashion, Dave Chappelle has done once again, I think by my count, this is about the third time in about a year or so, that he has challenged the dominant cultural narratives of the day. We heard him do it on the trans issue, we saw him do it on the abortion issue, and now here he is on Saturday Night Live touching on other hot button issues, and I think raising some fascinating challenges to the sort of dominant political and ideological narratives, the talking points of the day, if you like. And I think there's something very good and wholesome about this. This is exactly what a court jester should do and needs to do from time to time. They use their comedic skills to challenge the king or the queen's court and to sort of, I guess, represent the ordinary folk amongst the powers that be. And this example of his monologue from Saturday Night Live, I think, is a great example of him doing just that. So let's jump in. As I said, we're not going to listen to the whole thing. We're just going to listen to different segments. And one of the big themes, the big main comedy focus, if you like, of this monologue was the recent controversy surrounding Kanye West and the public comments that he made about the Jewish people. And so that's the through line to all of this. Let's jump in now and have a listen to some of the things that I think are a little bit more salient in this monologue and worth some consideration.
The Brooklyn show business rules. Is this a rule? You know, the rules of perception. If they're black, then it's a gang. If they're Italian, it's a mob. But if they're Jewish, it's a coincidence and you should never speak about it.
I think what he's saying there really is there's a double standard at play here. He's challenging the double standard. He's not saying it's okay to do what Kanye did. What he's saying is that if it's not okay in that situation, why is it okay to sort of stereotype and label other groups in other situations? Or maybe he's raising the question, is it actually okay to stereotype and highlight some of the stereotypes? Because funnily enough, in this monologue, we won't play the bit, but there is a bit in this monologue where he does a little bit of what you might call friendly, jovial stereotyping of Jewish people himself. He talks about his own experiences growing up. And I think the point here is that we live in a culture now that is highly censorious. This is a theme he keeps coming back to in his monologue. But also, it's now just overly censorious about things that, like, it's become precious about things that it really shouldn't be precious about. And the simple truth is that there are stereotypes that you can see and observe, and which, ironically, we probably would find funny if we were honest about this amongst different groups. And in fact, all groups do it. They notice stereotypical behavior in other groups. And in fact, comedy itself is built on, very often, is built on observing and playing off of those stereotypes. And the reason it works is because everyone recognizes the truth of a particular stereotype. The problem, of course, is when that crosses over into some sort of hatred or some sort of unhealthy, maybe racism or some sort of sexism or some sort of unvirtuous talk about an entire group. And so I think the challenge here, though, is that, you know, it's not so much what he said he's saying, is it's the fact that he's broken the rules of perception. He's broken the rules that that you're not allowed to, you're allowed to talk about some groups in certain ways, but you're not allowed to talk about other groups in that same way. And I think the challenge there is to the double standard.
Kyrie Irving posted a link to a movie that he had seen on Amazon. No caption on the post or nothing like that.
I should say here, by the way, Kyrie Irving is an NBA basketball player, for those who don't know.
But apparently this movie had some, I don't know, anti-Semitic tropes or something. It was some weird title, like From Hebrew to Negro or something. And the NBA told me he should apologize, and he was slow to apologize. And then the list of demands to get back in their good graces got longer and longer, and this is where, you know, I draw the line. I know the Jewish people have been through terrible things all over the world, but you can't blame that on black Americans. You just can't. You know what I mean? Thanks for the one person that said me.
This is an interesting trait. You see, whenever Dave Chappelle is doing comedy, he very easily slips between comedy and preaching, and he will highlight and point out something that he thinks is a problem in a culture or something that he wants to challenge, and then he surrounds it, pads it out with humor. It's a very effective thing to do, but he's one of those comedians who does that well. Other comedians, you just get sick of it. You know they're preaching and they're not doing the comedy thing, and they're not. Well, Chappelle walks the middle line relatively well, I think, when he's sort of in the space. It doesn't mean that I would necessarily agree with every point that he makes, but I think he does this reasonably well. In this is a recognition that every human being is flawed and fallible, and so what we shouldn't be doing is elevating one group and their ideas above another and sort of saying that they are immune to criticism. I think he's sort of acknowledging the fact that we are all flawed creatures who struggle to navigate the messiness of human relationships and interactions about issues in the world. And I think this point here that he makes about Kyrie Irving is really the idea that the reaction in his mind is just has become over the top now. They've gone from laying out legitimate criticisms about what Kanye has said and pushing back against that to now making demands that are unreasonable and over the top and blaming someone for something that you really can't blame them for. And I think the point here again is this idea of speech and our ability to speak freely. It's something that you hear him come back to multiple times during this monologue. It's really the through line is not actually Kanye. Kanye is the vehicle which allows Dave Chappelle to talk about the through line that he wants to talk about, which is really the question of speech and our reaction to speech from other people, even speech that we might find really hurtful or offensive. How should we react to that? It seems that's the underlying deeper question that he's trying to probe away at here with this particular monologue.
I saw one news pundit screaming about Kanye. She said, mental health is no excuse for that type of language. Yes, it is, bitch. You can kill somebody if you're mentally ill.
Now, this is a really interesting and I think very salient point here. And I've noticed this myself, actually, over the last couple of years. There's been this bizarre thing where people have tried to, in certain situations, to say that mental health, which clearly was a factor in someone's criminal offending, is actually not a factor in their criminal offending or should have nothing to do with the conversation about their offending. And most commonly I've seen this when it has come to like school shooters or white shooters in America, where what you've had is someone who clearly, amongst other issues, has serious mental health problems. They're alienated, they've gone down a rabbit hole, that particular mental health situation that they're in has exploded due to a combination of factors. It's not just that. But what's happened is people don't want to actually acknowledge. They say, no, you shouldn't talk about mental health because that makes people who actually experience mental health problems, that makes them effectively look bad. Now, I think there's a couple of reasons why people do this thing, because I don't think it's rational at all. Number one is because I think often, as I said, this has been about school shootings, and I think a lot of people want to focus on the question of gun control legislation and that political aspect of it all. And so I think for a lot of people, they are worried that if we start talking about all of the issues involved, which actually does include a person's mental state at the time they carry out this kind of crime, then that might dilute their ability to challenge the question of gun control laws. And to me, that's not helpful, because the reality is that in most of these cases, what you have is a situation where someone's mental health is not in a good place at all. There is a mental health crisis along with other factors, and you can include one of those factors would be their access to firearms, right? How easy was it for them to access firearms? Now, I think that's a factor in all of this. Number two, though, is I think that this is definitely an outworking of identity politics, and people are now so used to seeing people grouped into various identity markers that they sort of struggle to see them as individuals who might experience or act out in certain ways. And so what I mean by that is they sort of say, well, the mental health community. And so this is people who experience mental health struggles. Now, I'm someone in my life who has experienced mental health struggles. About 20 years ago, and totally out of the blue, I experienced a period of about 7 to 9 months or so of anxiety. And it was serious. I'd get these anxiety attacks out of nowhere. I had no idea what was going on. I remember one morning being on a soccer field and just absolutely being in this state of panic, playing soccer and thinking, I don't want to be here on the field, but I don't want to leave the field either. I didn't know what to do. And I literally remember chasing the ball down on the soccer field, trying to turn my mind off. It wasn't like I was suddenly distracted by the gameplay. It was like I was desperately running towards the gameplay so that I could shut my mind off and stop it doing whatever it was doing. I didn't understand what was going on at the time. I look back now and I see the various stress points that were at work in my life. I didn't recognize them as stress points. I didn't think of myself as being someone who was particularly vulnerable to stress, but lo and behold, I was, and I had this period where I had these issues. My father, I think I've talked about this before on the podcast, suffered from schizophrenia for most of his adult life. So I understand mental health issues. But what I don't do is I don't identify myself as being part of like a mental health community. I'm still me. I'm a person. I experienced that thing. And I think when you get embedded in and mired in identity politics, you sort of struggle to see the fact that, you know, individuals are still individuals, and we fail to sort of acknowledge individual agency. And what we tend to do is we tend to do dumb things like say, well, no, we shouldn't say that Kanye West might be experiencing a mental health crisis, because that implies somehow in the minds of identity politics that everyone who experiences a mental health crisis might also be labeled as anti-Semitic. Well, no, this is just crazy. This is so detached from reality. I saw my father when he experienced serious mental health crisis moments in his life, and they were serious. At one point, he thought he was the King of Ireland. It's just crazy to say that this is not an issue. I think also there is very much another thing being outworked here, and this is what Carl Truman rightly identifies as expressive individualism, this idea that you create your own identity, and that identity you create isn't just an identity, it is actually who you really are. And so if your identity is very much grounded in the mental health community, then all of a sudden, like, mental health isn't just an experience that a person can have, it's who you are. And so you think that you're somehow being tied and tarred and feathered along with Kanye West, when he, a man who, it seems that there may be some indication he is experiencing some sort of possible issues here. I don't know. I'm not going to judge the guy because I don't know. But if that was the case, then it's crazy to think that, well, mental health can't be an issue. And this crazy notion of this makes people who experience mental health, genuine mental health problems, to be bad. What do you mean by genuine mental health problems? Is it not possible for someone to experience a mental health crisis where they start saying crazy conspiratorial things? Because if you think that that's not true, you're not speaking truthfully. You don't understand reality. You don't understand mental illness. I lived with a man, my father, beautiful man. I loved him greatly. But there were moments of crisis, mental health crisis, where his thinking went conspiratorial. And so I understand this. This is a reality. And it's just crazy to me that people would even suggest that it's not a thing.
And I'm watching the news now. They're declaring the end of the Trump era. Now, okay, I can see how in New York you might believe this is the end of his era. I'm just being honest with you. I live in Ohio amongst the poor whites.
Isn't that interesting? He makes a comment about poor whites, and this group of well-to-do liberal types, they laugh at that. They think that's funny. They don't. And it seems to me that the people who are laughing, it's like in their mind, they didn't understand that, or they don't get that you can actually have poor white people, and that there are a lot of people out there who live in poverty who are not black or who are not brown. It's quite interesting to me, eh? It's as someone who grew up in a very poor white family, I find this so fascinating that you do get that sense that maybe they are disconnected a little bit from reality here. Their privileged position that they are sitting in makes them think, and they've been so mired in this whole identity politics and white people have all the privilege that they can't get their head around the fact that there might actually be a whole lot of white people who don't have the very privilege that they're claiming them to actually have. Very, very fascinating moment, that one.
A lot of you don't understand why Trump was so popular, but I get it because I hear it every day. He's very loved. And the reason he's loved is because people in Ohio have never seen somebody like him. He's what I call an honest liar. Well, I'm not joking right now. He's an honest liar. That first debate, I'd never seen anything like it. I've never seen a white male billionaire screaming at the top of his lungs, "This whole system is rigged," he said. And across the stage was a white woman, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, sitting over there looking at him like, "No, it's not." I said, "Now, wait a minute, bro. It's what he said."
Now, this is, again, another example of Dave Chappelle doing the preaching thing and doing it really well. And he's right. And what he's pointing out here, he's challenging the dominant cultural narrative of the day, which you hear from a lot of sources today. This idea that somehow Trump was an aberration, he was put there by Russia, or maybe it was all about fascism and Nazism or white supremacy or white nationalism. No, it's not. And a lot of people just can't get it or get their head around the fact that Donald Trump was a result of a system that is in a state of dysfunction. Donald Trump is the result of a series of corruptions within institutions, and he was the first guy who came along and just honestly, from within the system, really did challenge those corruptions and speak to those and speak honestly, like he's saying here about this. It's not fascism. It's not some Russian plot that put him there. It's the fact that a lot of ordinary, everyday people who have been living under the hegemony and the institutional takeover of both Enlightenment liberalism and cultural Marxism, they know that things are not as they should be. The great promises of the liberal order have not delivered. In fact, we'll hear more about this in just a second, the victim class is actually growing greater by the decade. And so this is what put Trump in power, but the powers that be, or those who live comfortably, if you like, within the framework of Enlightenment liberalism, and those who are very much part of the cultural Marxist clique and who live in that academic space, they don't want to acknowledge that there's anything wrong with their ideology. They just don't want to acknowledge that their ideology and its progeny and what it's given rise to could ever be the problem. Instead, they want to pin the problem on some sort of conspiracy theory or Russian interference or some sort of nefarious plot to undermine democracy, etc. It's a failure to actually recognize the bigger problem here. And when you have his challenge about Obama and Clinton sitting there trying to defend the system, in other words, what he's saying here is no, Trump was actually telling the truth and these people were lying, and that's a big part of the problem. And the ordinary everyday people who are on the receiving end of these bad outcomes, they know that things are not as they could be. They know that things aren't as healthy and stable as one side is claiming. And so all of a sudden, Trump was a sort of an antidote to that. And ironically, these same people will then turn around and claim that the system is corrupt and has been corrupt for hundreds and hundreds of years when they start talking about the evils of colonialism and the concept of white privilege and patriarchy and everything else. So when it suits them, they'll tell you that the entire scheme is a sham, the institutions, they're all corrupt, they're all evil. But then when it doesn't suit them, when they want to maintain and retain power and control, they'll tell you to your face, as Obama and Clinton tried to do, no, there's no problem here, no problem at all. And it wasn't just on the Democrat side either, by the way. There are a lot of people on the Republican side who quite liked the status quo as well and were very much, I think, threatened by the fact that along comes this guy who actually wants to throw a hand grenade amongst their very comfortable system that they've got used to, and they move and sort of navigate quite easily and with a lot of privilege along the way.
No one ever heard someone say something that true. And then Hillary Clinton tried to punch him in the taxes. She said, this man doesn't pay his taxes. He shot right back. That makes me smart. And then he said, if you want me to pay my taxes, then change the tax code. But I know you won't, because your friends and your donors enjoy the same tax breaks that I do.
Wasn't that an interesting moment? There's something uncomfortable in that moment. And there's, you hear a couple of people sort of going, acknowledging that he's actually telling the truth here. This is a really big moment in this monologue. And basically what he's pointing out here is the hypocrisy. There is this absurd tribalism that we are dominated by now, and I see it all over the place, and people have got themselves tied in knots because they insist on sticking with a tribe, and I think that's sort of inevitable in the situation that we find ourselves in. We'll talk more about that in a moment, but there is this hypocrisy here, and people stick with their tribe, and it doesn't matter. They'll turn a blind eye to the errant behavior from their tribe, and they will point out those same behaviors in the other tribe and claim that it's the worst thing ever. You see this a lot on Twitter. Both sides of the political spectrum are often yelling at each other and accusing each other of the same evils. They're both doing it. They sound identical at times. It's such a fascinating thing to see in action. I've talked a lot about this with the Disinformation Project and the whole moral panic that's going on right now in New Zealand. You've got a group of people on the progressive side who are promoting conspiracy theories, and they are doing it in the name of challenging the conspiratorial conspiracy theories of the other side. And so you've got both sides of the political spectrum who are throwing around conspiracy theories about what the state of the world, or what they think the state of the world, or what they think the real problems are, and they're missing the wood for the trees in all of this. And this is the thing. This is the hypocrisy of all of this. One thing that is starting to become more apparent, though, is that for those who are on the progressive side, hypocrisy is not really something that they are willing to own. It's something that they are willing to accuse their conservative opponents of. But when they engage in hypocrisy, they don't really own it, because as far as they're concerned, the system is so dysfunctional, they need to do whatever it takes to tear it down. It's a revolutionary attitude. And revolutionaries don't care about morality. Their focus is burning the system down and then rebuilding it in their own image. And so hypocrisy, well, that's not something that really applies to them, because, as they would say, you've got to break a few eggs to make an omelette. And so that is an increasing problem here, the hypocrisy about hypocrisy itself.
And with that, my friends, a star was born. No one had ever seen anything like that. No one had ever seen somebody come from inside of that house, outside, and tell all the commoners, we are doing everything that you think we are doing inside of that house.
Again, this is Chappelle pointing out the current hypocrisy in all of this. Now, why is this happening, though? Why? There are problems within the institutions, is what he's saying here. He's saying Trump is right. And the reason a lot of people love the guy and voted for the guy was because he was honest about that fact. And the supposed people's champions all over the political spectrum aren't really the people's champions. And it's just so clear to see how they are very much part of these institutional corruptions, or they benefit from them, and they're not really willing to tackle them head on. There's a much bigger issue here. It's fascinating to me. I've seen even some Christian people over the last year or two bemoaning the fact that there is a loss of trust in the institutions, and they wished that somehow that we could sort of promote an increased or a recovery of trust in the institutions. And they don't like it when people even challenge the corruption of the institutions, because they see that as a threat, if you like, and that is sort of propagating that same problem. It's furthering the loss of trust. You know, all you're doing is fostering cynicism. But the problem is with that approach is that it fails to recognize that this is a two-way street, that trust in the institutions isn't simply about an unhealthy cynicism in the people. That's definitely a factor. We'll talk about that in just a second. But it's also about the fact that those institutions themselves are now regularly, for various reasons, they've been captured by ideologies, by corporate interests, by various things that have created a situation of corruption within the institutions. And a big part of this is because of the loss of the sacred order. And it's very ironic, because we have spent decades now telling people that they should be skeptical about the institutions. And so much of this has actually come from on the back of Enlightenment liberalism and then cultural Marxism. And so what you get is the situation where these progressives who constantly claim, a la Karl Marx, that history, all of history, is actually a history of struggle, and it's a history of power struggle where one group is dominating another group, and that's what history is. And so basically what that means is that your institutions, as Marx would tell you and is what they're really proclaiming here, the institutions are always corrupt. It's about the powerful dominating and oppressing the vulnerable. And so you've been telling people this for decades. You've been saying, fight the man, don't trust the system, all this kind of stuff. And then you act surprised when suddenly people turn around and say, yeah, the institutions can't be trusted. And for me, as a conservative, I find that really sad, because these institutions actually do play an important role in society, and the loss of these institutions and the corruption of these institutions is not a good thing. Now, because I am a Judeo-Christian conservative, I also understand that I am not living in a world where we can ever achieve utopia. We are born into a fallen world, and we are born sinful ourselves, and we have this propensity, this proclivity towards selfishness and sinfulness and corruption. When we get lots of power, we like it, and we are not very good at reining that power in. There's a reason why everyone just nods their head in agreement, regardless of their politics, when you say things like absolute power corrupts absolutely. Most people understand and agree with that. They don't see themselves as being part of that problem often, but they agree with that because they know that's true. It's objectively true. It's why people say, oh, the power or the money or the fame has gone to his head. They know exactly what you're talking about there. They know that a certain level of power has a corrupting influence upon character. And so this is the thing. We live in a world, a fallen world, where if you lose your sacred order, then what are you left with? You're left with fallible, corrupt human beings who are creating now a brand new system in their own image. They're not even looking to the image of God anymore, which, despite the fact that that would be much better, was still not perfect, because we're frail, flawed human beings, right? There is no utopia. It's not possible. And so when you talk about the loss of trust in the institutions, you've got to understand the deeper problems going on here. We are absolutely suffering as a result of the loss of the sacred order. The Judeo-Christian vision of reality has been abandoned. And not just abandoned, but it has been turned on. And so all of a sudden, we're left now with the situation where we are struggling with corrupted institutions and with a society that is cynical about things and has no real sense of meaning and no vision beyond the here and now. And so this just is a recipe for disaster. It's a recipe for really, really bad and intense political tribalism, because if this life is all you've got and this world is all you've got, then you better fight tooth and nail, and you better, you know, be prepared to go to war against your enemies who threaten to bring in a new system that you don't like. And that's a real problem. That's not a good thing at all. And that's what the loss of the sacred order does. It's a loss of perspective. Your horizon is lowered. You have a reductionist view that does not give a full accounting for reality. And there's a whole lot of bad effects that flow on from that reductionist view of the human person, the human experience, and reality itself, that is reduced to nothing more than a sort of a material existence, an atheistic philosophical materialism that is left with nothing other than raw matter, and then tries to find all the solutions at the level of nothing other than raw matter. And so, yeah, this is really, really salient, the point that he's making here. There is a problem in the institutions. It's hypocritical or nonsensical to pretend otherwise.
Now the midterms are over and everybody's awake. These new whites, man, they're like, the whites, they're like newborn babies. Just woke up. Everything white people are mad about, we've been on that. Man, I can't feed my family. Black people are like, we've been on that. Man, we can't trust the government. We've been on that. Man, we should dismantle the FBI. Word to Martin Luther King, bro. We've been on that.
That was such a fascinating moment. Because here he is. He's serious. It's obvious by the tone of his voice and the look on his face. Not once does he do the usual Dave Chappelle tells, which is where he makes facial gestures to show you that he's being mischievous or that he is joking around. This was Dave the preacher, and he is speaking clearly. Three times there, he talks about these realities of how people can be victimized when the institutions become corrupted. And these people are laughing at it. And then the very final one is about the FBI being a sort of a corrupt enforcement wing of the current regime. Doesn't matter who it is, but it's used as a tool by them to enforce their mandates and target their opponents. And they're all clapping and cheering because he mentions the obvious truth about how this was done to Martin Luther King Jr. and how we understand through the civil rights era that this was a problem. And now all of a sudden these same people who are clapping and cheering here don't seem to put two and two together about what this might actually mean for the current progressive Democratic regime and how they might be using the FBI for their own ends. What a fascinating moment. Absolutely fascinating. To me, it just is such an Orwellian moment there. We've got these people laughing and clapping about this, but not really thinking deeply about what they are actually agreeing to here. It's such a funny thing about the human condition, isn't it? We often don't go beyond the superficial or the surface. We're not seeing the deeper implications for what our acknowledgement of these truths actually means, what it really does mean. It's not an uncommon problem, and it's not just this audience, it's all of us. We can fall prey to that. But what a fascinating moment that was.
Nobody listens to me when I tell these jokes. You ignore me. My first Netflix special, what did I say? I said, I don't want a sneaker deal because the minute I say something that makes those people mad, they're going to take my sneakers away. And the whole crowd's like, ha, 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 ha. But now you see Kanye walking around L.A. barefoot with his chain out.
What he's doing there is he's telling you two things. Number one, he's telling you that he has been playing the role of the jester for a long time now. He has been using comedy as a tool to try and challenge the dominant cultural narratives of the day. So he's saying that. I've been doing this for a long time. And number two is, what the implication here is that we are effectively living under a type of corporate oligarchy. This is the funny thing to me. We like to think how advanced and enlightened we are and, oh, thank goodness we're not like those backwater nations and, oh, we're not like Russia. Look at the oligarchical control of that nation and what's happened there. And look how advanced we are. We've got rid of the aristocracy. Aren't we clever? And what are we living under now? I would say we're living under a regime that's much worse. We've got people who have this almost absolute power and control with no accountability. They've got their fingers in every pie. They're making moral demands and demands about the moral life of individual citizens and what they should and shouldn't believe about the world around them. They're involved at the political level. They're involved in cancelling people when they want to. They have no belief in a sacred order that they believe themselves to be accountable to, a higher power that is higher than them and the power they wield, that one day they will stand before and give an account for how they wield the power that they have been granted in this life. And we're sort of sitting here acting like somehow this is better or an improved situation. It's not a good thing at all. And it's not just that, but again, this is this notion that he keeps hitting on, as I said, during this monologue. The big thing here, the big through line, is about freedom to actually speak and what that means. And I'm reminded here when he talks about, you know, not getting a sneaker deal, of the old anecdote about the king who had philosophers in his court, and the unspoken rule was that if you offended the king and you didn't tell the king what he wanted to hear, if you're a philosopher, then you would be banished from the king's table and you wouldn't be allowed to eat the nice roast meats at the king's feast each night. Instead, you'd be banished to the back room outside the kitchen where all you had to eat was a bowl of lentils. And there was one philosopher who was known for saying things the king didn't want to hear, and so he was constantly eating lentils out the back of the kitchen. And one day one of his philosopher friends saw him and he said, look, mate, if you would just tell the king what he wanted to hear, then you wouldn't have to sit out the back eating lentils all the time. You could eat the nice, fine roast meats at the king's table. And this philosopher turned to his friend and said, well, if you were okay with eating lentils every night, then you wouldn't have to compromise your integrity and be beholden to the king. And there's something really truthful and important about that. Again, this is this whole notion we've just spoken about a few minutes ago. Power corrupts. You know, the fame, the money, the power has gone to his head. This is what it's talking about. It means that your character, something has gone wrong in your character. And it's a real challenge for any of us. And you see this all over the place today. I think it's one of the biggest challenges now in the political arena. When you've lost the Christian sacred order, which is very much grounded in this notion that you must commit yourself to a life of virtue, that you will be held accountable at the end of time for your actions, that there is a perfect and good judge who will judge all of us for our sins and for the good things that we've done in our life, and we will be held accountable for those things, your behavior is very different when you're in politics, I would suggest. Now, it doesn't mean you're going to be perfect, and it doesn't mean you're immune to the corrupting influence of power, but I think that's a better situation to be in than having a whole lot of people who just don't believe they're accountable to anything beyond themselves, and they wield these unaccountable levels of power. And on top of that, you've got a media establishment that effectively just pats them on the back and doesn't really hold them accountable in any meaningful way either. That's a recipe for disaster. That's not a good thing for society at all.
It shouldn't be this scary to talk about anything. It's making my job incredibly difficult. And to be honest with you, I'm getting sick of talking to a crowd like this. I love you to death. And I thank you for your support. And I hope they don't take anything away from me. Whoever they are.
What a fascinating way to finish out this monologue. And like I said, you see here that the through line through this monologue is not actually Kanye. It's the issue of freedom, really, and freedom of expression in particular. It shouldn't be this scary to talk. Now, this is the typical jester at work you see here on the part of Dave Chappelle. He starts with several really salient and very serious points, and then he ends it with a mischievous little joke to sort of let you off the hook so that you can feel safe and comfortable to sit there and listen to him and even quietly agree with him and not have to lambast and criticize and call for his cancellation because he's given you that out, and the out is at the very end when he cracks that little joke. So this is the way humor can actually disarm an audience and help you to really present a message. It's a very, very important communications tip that you are seeing in action here from Dave Chappelle. The important bit, though, is when he says it shouldn't be this scary to talk. The joke is not the important bit. The honest bit is when he talks about how he's sick of doing this and he's getting fed up with this, and how this is, he's basically seeing a problem that is not being addressed, and it's clearly not being resolved at all, and it's ongoing, and he's constantly coming up against it time and time again. This is because we are living now under Herbert Marcuse's repressive tolerance. Herbert Marcuse, one of the most prominent members of the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory, and his big notion of repressive tolerance was this idea that you actually have to repress ideas, philosophies, expressions that challenge the cultural Marxist ideology because they pose a threat. There's an awareness that if people are allowed to actually think for themselves and speak truthfully, they might say and think things that will threaten the power of those who want to wield that power and, you know, rebuild the world in their own image. And we're living under that. That's the reality of that. And if you put this into context with what he said just previously about the sneaker deal, you realize that if more of us were actually willing to eat lentils out the back of the kitchen instead of sitting and enjoying the finer things of life and being invited to all the right tables at all the right times, then maybe things would be different. If a few more of us had the courage and the willingness to actually speak truthfully and not censor ourselves. I think the greatest weapon and the most effective tool right now is actually the fearful self-censorship that is going on. People who are afraid. And you can see how that is, it's not just about bad ideas, like really, really, really bad ideas that people are self-censoring. It's now turned conversation and public discourse itself into this political power game. And if you don't say the right thing or the right words that conforms to the hegemony of the day, you will be targeted and you will be cancelled, or you will be ridiculed. Your reputation will be slandered and destroyed. It doesn't matter. It might be the slightest thing that you just didn't quite get right. It doesn't matter. This is a regime and an ideology that doesn't do mercy. This is Herbert Marcuse's repressive tolerance. We must destroy the old in order to rebuild the new in our own image, and we will not tolerate any dissent. That's the simple reality of it. Right, let's finish up with a slightly longer episode, as I said. Today in history, November the 18th, 1874. Cleveland, Ohio today saw the foundation of the Woman's Christian Temperance Union under the secretaryship of the charismatic Miss Frances Elizabeth Caroline Willard, president of the Evanston College for Ladies. The aims of the WCTU are to protect the home and develop Christian citizenship through individual commitment to abstinence, that's from alcohol, and the abolition of the liquor trade. Its formation is a consequence of the Women's Temperance Crusade of 1873 and 74, in which militant women frequently invaded saloons to sing hymns and kneel in prayer. Indeed, there is a political element to the union's aims, since insobriety and the ill treatment of women so often go hand in hand. So there you go. Today in history, November the 18th, 1874, the foundation of the Women's Christian Temperance Union in Cleveland, Ohio. Thanks for tuning in. Don't forget, live by goodness, truth, and beauty, not by lies. And I will see you next time on The Dispatches. On the Clock is brought to you by Left Foot Media. Support our important independent media work at patreon.com/leftfootmedia with just $5 or more per month, and you'll receive exclusive access to our full-length, patrons-only episode of the Dispatches podcast every single week. That's patreon.com/leftfootmedia. Link is in the show notes.